In today's episode, Sean and I are joined by Alastair Walker. Alastair shares how he went through 7 failed IVF rounds to natural conception. If you've ever been told there is nothing more you can do, this episode will bring you hope. Enjoy. Welcome to the Male Fertility Podcast. Today we are joined by an absolute legend, Alastair Walker.
Thank you for having me on the podcast. Kind of discovered you guys this year and been binging on your episodes since then, and you guys are a real inspiration for everything in the male fertility space, I think, now, and I'm really thankful to be here.
Oh, it's a pleasure as always. Thanks for coming and thanks for your kind words.
Yeah, thank you, buddy. It's always nice to hear that people are listening, obviously, but it's lovely when people say those kind words, so thanks so much. And let's start right at the beginning for you, buddy. Tell us about life before your fertility journey and the build up to it. How did it all start?
Life before was spent time at university, studied physics at university, and then I did a doctorate in biomedical engineering and lived that kind of extended student lifestyle throughout my 20s. And yeah, I got married and spent a lot of time outdoors doing active pursuits, kayaking and hill walking and all the things that you should do if you're living in Scotland. So yeah, keeping myself active and enjoying all that green space that we've got. I met Julia in my mid-20s and we were together for about 6 years before we got married. And yeah, like first year of marriage, didn't have any kind of expectations to be any problems with fertility. And it was kind of a surprise. It was Julia got like an inner ear infection. She just started kind of being sick one day and couldn't stand up, couldn't keep her balance, went to the GP. The GP sort of said, "Oh, this sounds like labyrinthitis," which I hadn't heard of at the time. And she did say, "Oh, could you be pregnant?" And Julia said, "Well, you know, been trying." She said, "How long?" "Well, you know, about a year," which I thought was maybe overselling it a little bit. I thought, I don't think it's been a year. But yeah, well, so I wasn't worried and she wasn't really worried. So they said, "Okay, checked out and see what's going on." So Julia got checked out and everything was fine. And I thought, yeah, everything's fine. Of course it's fine. We're pregnant in no time. And eventually I got around to getting tested as well because the GP said, "Oh, you both get tested." So I went away and got my semen analysis done a month or so later. And then I got a call saying, "Well, can you come back and repeat your semen analysis?" And kind of coming from a science background, I knew that you don't tend to repeat results, you know, unless something's a bit abnormal. And I thought they're probably not asking me to repeat the result to tell me just how good my sperm count is. It wasn't like they were phoning up saying, you know, this is world record stuff. So I kind of knew pretty quickly where this was going. So I started spiraling about that point and then went and repeated my semen analysis and got the results. On the day, I said to the guy, "Look, you know, is there something there? Is there nothing there? What's the story?" He said, "I'm not really supposed to tell you, but I can tell you there is something, but it is a low count." Okay, so I started looking up, what does a low count look like? What does that look like for us? And the GP called and said, yeah, your sperm count was down at 200,000 per mil, which is significantly reduced sperm count. You're looking for 50 million plus per mil to be at the kind of bottom end of normal. And yeah, well below a million wasn't such a good result. Yeah, that was how we started our fertility journey, was getting a phone call at work from the GP and then going and figuring out what to do next. So
yeah. How did you feel when that phone call came? What was your first initial thought? Because obviously they'd ask you to retake the test and there's that question mark in your head. Did they give you any information supporting it, or did you have to go out and kind of investigate it a bit yourself? Because you've talked about what it should be. So there's two questions there. One, how did you first feel? And two, were you proactive in researching that, or did they give you the information that you needed?
Yeah, it was like a gut punch. It was pretty bad, especially going from not really, although I'd been expecting it for maybe a day or so, not really expecting it at all in my life till that point. Yeah, it was quite an impactful moment to kind of hear that. And then I wouldn't say there was an awful lot of support came with it. Like, my GP was quite good. I quite liked my GP, but they weren't particularly familiar with what the right numbers were, and they'd been told by the embryologist that that was a severely reduced count, but they didn't really know what normal was or what normal looked like. So there wasn't an awful lot of supporting information to come with it. I just asked at the time, like, by that point I'd done my research a little bit. I knew that was severely reduced and that was definitely into kind of IVF, ICSI territory. So I just said, like, well, where should we go for IVF then? Because I knew kind of quickly that's where we're at. I'd heard anecdotally that the waiting list for the NHS at the time was kind of into the years, and I think we knew we didn't want to do that. So I asked her for advice on where to go for a private round of IVF, and she recommended a place in Glasgow that was where we kind of started our IVF journey, the GCRM, the Glasgow Centre for Reproductive Medicine. So that's where we started with IVF, Nixie.
Wow. So it was literally like low count identified, and then, okay, you best have IVF then. No other information, no other tests.
Yeah, pretty much. That's pretty much how it went. I turned up to the clinic and they did the sort of standard introductory clinical exams and an understatement analysis and confirmed that result. Had the first consultation at the clinic, and at the time for the first round, I just sort of went with it. I just sort of started, my initial instinct was that I'll just go with it, listen to the experts and see what they have to say, and then just take it from there. And then that changed quite dramatically over the course of my IVF journey. In the first instance, it was just go with it, and had our first round of IVF, which I didn't really do anything in terms of lifestyle to prepare for it. I just went on with life as normal. I think I maybe cut back on drinking a little bit, and we had our first round of IVF, and I think we had something like 6 eggs and 5 mature and like all 5 fertilized or something like that. So it was like, on the initial day, it seemed like, well, this isn't so bad.
Mm.
It'd be nice with more eggs, but it doesn't sound like such a bad fertilization rate. But all the embryos failed at day 3, and then we did transfer something on day 5, but it wasn't even a blastocyst for those who are familiar with the IVF round technicalities. So that wasn't a good outcome. And then it was at the outcome discussion after that first round that I spoke to the doctor, and he mentioned if we saw this pattern again of embryos failing at day 3, it might indicate a severe problem with the sperm quality, and it could be something to do with DNA fragmentation. And that was the first time I'd heard of DNA fragmentation, and my ears perked up, and it did sound like he said, if we see this pattern again, it might not be worth our while trying beyond the second round. So that's when I started to go away and do my own research, and having come from a research doctorate kind of background, especially in the life sciences, I didn't feel, I wasn't overwhelmed or scared by that. I knew where to go for information.
Hmm.
I knew how to go away and research these sorts of things. So I wasn't too worried about that. So that was something where everything changed.
I think it's so common that people find themselves having to navigate this path, do just put full trust and confidence into the doctors who have trained for many years to get where they are. And yeah, it's a shame when, if in this case, there's perhaps not the, or any, not even requisite, but like any investigations going on, or even advice about lifestyle to at least get the sperm that you did have into optimal quality condition. How long ago was this, sorry, again?
This was 2017, towards the end of 2017, autumn of 2017. So a year after we were married. And yeah, like looking back, and I think even at the time, I was really quite surprised that there was no lifestyle advice given. There was no male factor investigations done. Even though we were presenting with a male factor infertility, presenting with a severe sperm problem, I was really quite surprised that it was sort of straight ICSI was the kind of recommended solution. I do remember talking about that at the time, thinking, well, should we not just investigate what's going on with me? And the kind of attitude was, oh, well, if there's sperm, ICSI will work. What's the problem? And I thought, well, yeah, but, you know, like, it'd be nice to do a kind of root cause analysis and figure out what's going on. But that wasn't what happened.
Yeah, there definitely seems to be a thought process that there's one route. As soon as it's identified as a male issue, well, you've just got to go to ICSI. And you'll echo how I felt about it, Alistair, is the fact of I wanted to know what the problem was. I was like, well, there's clearly an issue. Yes, I can understand the treatment, but I still haven't got an answer to my question. Why has this happened? You know, what's wrong with me? Is this going to play out in my long-term health? All these questions that you have, which don't get addressed, or certainly hadn't previously. You know, and it's not just an IVF journey or ICSI journey. It's how can I fix it? How can I be like I'm meant to be? And when that isn't supported, or what you perceive how you're meant to be, yeah, it's really challenging. And there is definitely a mindset that there's a one path route. Male factor it is changing slowly, but you're one of thousands, possibly millions of guys that have that question. You know, yeah. What else do I need to know? Why am I just doing this? Can it improve itself? Which we're going to get onto, because I think, you know, you're the perfect example of what happens when you actually look into the situation and deal with the issue at hand. We've talked about you've got your diagnosis, you've been told certain things, and you're on this road to ICSI. You have a cycle, it doesn't go well, and then you're told by a doctor that if it goes a similar pattern, it could be DNA fragmentation. And that's got your attention. Did they actually say that it might not be worth carrying on? Or how did you explain it?
It was, you know, quite a bit worse. And this was all over the course of not very long, because we had approached a private clinic immediately. This was all happening over the course of 5 or 6 weeks, kind of from thinking everything's fine to being told, you know, IVF might not work for you. You know, kind of quite a lot to take in over a relatively short period of time.
Did they suggest anything else if it didn't work? Was it just an off-the-cuff comment? It's not a bit of news that you don't want to hear, but there is an element of you may have had that conversation at some point. Would it have been a softer blow if they had said, but this is what we could look into?
Yeah, I think so. I think it'd be nice to be strung along a little bit longer, like just to make that blow a little bit more gentle. But I guess everybody's different. I guess the clinicians have to kind of manage the fact everybody is different and everybody receives news differently. I think I would have liked to have had a softer blow than that. I think I came out of the first round thinking, it's never going to work the first time. That's okay. It'll work the second or third time. That's fine. Which didn't end up being the case.
You mentioned like the way that they broke. I don't even know what to call it. It's not really advice, but just after what happened with the first round, the kind of flippancy of the way in which it was said, all right, okay, well, give it another go and, you know, consider might not be worth it. Look at DNA frag, etc. And he went off to do some research. So where did that probably, I'd imagine, quite lengthy rabbit hole take you?
Yeah. So literally where it took me was, I think, my living room floor. I think I got my laptop and I lay down on the floor and spent 3 days just going around Google Scholar and trying to figure out what the reputable journals in the field were, and read about 100 or 200 abstracts on what was the state of the art in the field in terms of what lifestyle factors you can control when it comes to male fertility, sperm counts, that sort of stuff. I was kind of just in my own head, in my own space, just doing my own thing, quite comfortable I was getting somewhere. I was actually finding relevant information. I was getting useful stuff. So I did ask in the clinic, like, what can I do? What lifestyle factors can I take into consideration here? And I got nothing back, really. Just eat a balanced diet. And I honestly couldn't be more fed up with the notion of a healthy, balanced diet. That's not what I want to hear. And I don't want to hear people telling me to eat a Mediterranean diet either, because what does that mean? Pizza and lasagna? Like, that suits me. I don't want to hear balanced diet. A
couple of Peronis, yeah.
Exactly, yeah. That's not what I want to hear, but I want to hear, like, specific actionable advice, something I can take away and work with. And I was quite surprised how little of that there was. And really, there was nobody to speak to about it at the time. And that's changed. That's changing in this space. But yeah, that was quite frustrating. So yeah, it was like on the kind of PubMed and Google Scholar and all these places for getting all these academic journals and figuring out what I could be doing to improve my kind of sperm count. And yeah, like latching onto certain things that were like eating walnuts was one, eating pomegranates was another one, and consuming low-fat dairy instead of high-fat dairy and cutting back on alcohol. And I'd never smoked, so I wasn't worried about the smoking. That seemed to be a big thing for a lot of men. So yeah, just looking at all of that sort of stuff and trying to build a lifestyle that was full of marginal gains. So there's no kind of magic bullets of diet or lifestyle or anything that you can do that's going to be instantly change everything overnight, but improve those kind of small evidence-based improvements.
And from what you found, is I know that what you've said, like the Mediterranean diet, that's people trying to almost give a very broad, objective piece of advice very quickly. With your research, did you find there are a lot of common themes, or is there a very subjective nature to what people should do?
Yeah, there was common themes. I think there was a very consistent message in terms of diet. That there was a very consistent message of eating lots of nuts was one of the ones that I read about a lot at the time, like really a lot of walnuts. There was a big Spanish 30 nuts study that came out saying that if you 60 grams of walnuts, almonds and hazelnuts a day, you get a dramatic boost in sperm counts and semen analyses and sperm quality as well. Same goes for cutting out high-fat dairy and cutting out alcohol. That one's a little bit more nuanced. The alcohol thing has been so widely studied because, of course, people, they want one answer and they keep getting the other answer. And the same goes for coffee and caffeine. And so people have really studied it in a great deal of depth as a consequence of that. And you do get a more nuanced result, which is that some degree, again, of one of those things that you don't want to hear, of moderation is okay. But specifically, what does moderation mean? I think in terms of coffee, it's probably one cup a day. Or in terms of alcohol, it's probably one glass of wine or maybe two beers a day if you're talking about bottles of beer. But that's what moderation looks like in terms of alcohol and caffeine. And figuring all that sort of stuff out was like, okay, this kind of works for me. I can have my one cup of coffee a day. I don't mind cutting down to one. And, you know, I can cut back on the booze or cut it out altogether. Cutting out cheese was more challenging for me. And replacing cheese with things like walnuts was definitely challenging.
Yeah, to put context on that, if it was a home delivery from a supermarket and you ordered cheese and they turned up with walnuts as a substitute, you'd be pretty annoyed. So trying to do that constantly in your diet, I can understand, is quite a change. Yeah, take us through the next stage of your journey. So you've started to make some lifestyle adjustments after some heavy research. And what was next for you guys?
Yeah, a bunch of lifestyle changes in terms of diet. And then we were going to the gym quite a lot at the time, started doing other types of stuff, got a personal trainer, started doing more kind of powerlifting, lower impact stuff, like not doing so much HIIT, not doing so much high intensity running. And I was doing like an interval sprints on the treadmill before that and decided to cut that back. I'd never looked into the exercise stuff extensively. I looked into it a little bit. I was always quite happy. It was the one part of my life. I was always quite happy just delegating that to somebody else. I just wanted to speak to my personal trainer and just tell me what to do. And I just said to him, I don't want to do HIIT. I don't want to work to exhaustion. I just want to do some moderate intensity, lots of lifting, lots of legs, and just, and he was happy to just run with that, and that was good fun. So I did that right up until COVID, really. I was quite enjoying doing that. And yeah, when we came to our second round of IVF, about 3 or 4 months later, my sperm count had gone from the 200,000, 100,000 or so. The first semen analysis had been to 3.2 million per mil. So it was a kind of 16 times increase in my sperm count just based on the lifestyle factors had changed. And the quality had gone up as well. So it had gone from, the motility had gone from, it wasn't even noted down as a number. It was like a severely reduced sperm count with very occasional motile sperm. So basically a pretty crap sperm count, and morphology was always 0%. So nothing had a normal shape. And then in the second round of IVF, I'd been, you know, count of 3.2 million, motility of like 20%, morphology of 1%, gone from 0 to 1. So that was fine. 0 to 20 on motility. So again, this was like quite a dramatic improvement. And then we had our second round of IVF and we got a blastocyst at day 5 and we got pregnant. So that felt like this is a win. This has worked. This has been really good. And then it didn't work out. We had a miscarriage about 6 or 7 weeks in. I can't remember exactly what it was, but which then threw me down another rabbit hole of sperm quality being an impact, having an impact on miscarriage rates, and just having this, like, that's when I started to feel this sort of sense of this just being a cycle of like rinse repeat of like, this is just a cycle of hope and then a cycle of despair and trying to pick yourself back up again and go again. We had a variety of runs in that time. I'll not take you through all of them because that really is just a rinse repeat story. Round 3 was another failure, early stage. I dropped off again. Round 4 was different clinic. We'd moved to the NHS by that point and we didn't have an awful lot of eggs on that particular round. So another failure quite early. Round 5, I was in a pretty good state. I was in pretty good health. I hadn't had any illnesses or coughs or colds or anything. And I was going into it feeling a bit more confident. The NHS had kind of understimulated Julia for round 4 and decided to increase her hormonal dose for round 5. And it looked like from the scans, the ovary scans, it looked like we were going to get a lot of eggs. The interesting thing that happened then was, so Julia works in healthcare as well, not as a doctor. And on day 9 of a 10-day stimulation cycle, she needle stuck herself at work with a patient who'd been abroad somewhere a bit sketchy. So she was really, really upset and she turned up to occupational health and, you know, did her thing. They have to go through And the guy said to her, "You seem very, very upset for just having needles like yourself. It happens all the time. Is everything okay?" And she was like blubbering out to him, you know, on 9 days into hormonal stimulation from a fifth round of IVF, and they're going to find out. We're going to have to tell them, and they're going to cancel the round. So we did phone them up and we did tell them what happened, and they scrambled a little bit to try to get us into a different clinic in Dundee that specialized in IVF for couples who maybe have HIV and stuff like that. Not that either of us had or suspected we would have, but there was always the risk that this needle stick injury could have resulted in like an HIV infection, and they couldn't take that risk in their lab to take our eggs in and to grow our embryos in there. So they were going to cancel the round, and the clinic in Dundee couldn't take us. They didn't have space. You know, Julia was very upset and expressed that quite clearly. Not angry, just crying on the phone to the clinic. And they said the only way we could get to deal with this would be to get the patient in to the clinic and get a blood test to confirm that they don't have HIV. So she phoned her work, and they organized for this patient to come along the next morning, which happened to be a Saturday. And the patient turned up and got a blood test done and confirmed there was no HIV, and we were allowed to take our trigger injection and release all the eggs, and we did end up having a round of IVF, and it felt all very poignant, and we did get two blastocysts and we implanted them both and we got pregnant again. So it felt like all that effort, all that getting this guy to come along and do a blood test and all that trauma, and, you know, kind of expressing to somebody you don't really know very well that what you're going through and why it's important for them to turn up to the clinic and get a blood test done. It all just felt like quite a lot. And then to get pregnant was such another moment of hope. But it was the same story. It ended up in London miscarriage, I think, pretty much Christmas Day or around Christmas Day. I can't remember exactly what it was, but it was a tough Christmas. And that was round five.
Yes, that's quite a round. putting it gently, isn't it, man? You talked about how your wife felt. How did you feel when obviously she rang and told you what happened?
She was so upset, and I was just focused on supporting her, really. And like, this was like the fifth round, and watching her go through this hormonal stimulation and the egg retrieval four times already, and this was the fifth time for the hormonal stimulation, and quite a significant. It's like it was 450 IU that she was on. Again, if it's relevant to anyone who's listening. So yeah, significant dose of hormones on a short protocol. So I was just trying to do what I could to support her on that particular day, because that was a pretty bad day for her. When they said that they were going to cancel the round, it was like pretty crushed, because I thought I was in pretty good shape. And that was like a really important factor for us going into a round of IVF. It was like, well, what kind of state am I in? Like, is my sperm going to be any good? And in this case, it was good. I think it was something like a count of 2 million per mil and really good motility and morphology. And then, of course, we did get pregnant. I think we got 18 eggs on that round. It was a significant yield of eggs. And yeah, there you go. Another ultimately another disappointing outcome.
Yeah, but credit to the guy who turned up, though. He may never truly understand how important that was to you. A challenging cycle, that, mate. Yeah, and there'll be people out there that will be listening to this and go, we went through a similar thing, but they've never talked about it. That's what we try and do with this pod, isn't it? Try and give people the opportunity to hear things that they would have been through, felt. And that's a very unique situation. So thank you for sharing that. So we've had another failed cycle six. How does that go? Is it a rinse and repeat again?
Not a rinse and repeat. Can't remember the details of it now, but it wasn't a success. And at that point, it was like, okay, this is now six failed rounds, or at least two, you could argue, partially successful rounds, but I don't know if I would go that far. We did have a candid conversation with one of the doctors at the time who I quite liked, and he said, this isn't the end of the road. We don't think this is the end of the road for you, so you keep trying. And by this point, maybe I should have mentioned earlier in the story, like, I was aware that I had a varicocele. I don't know when I became aware of that, but I was aware of that at some point throughout this cycle, and I'd been told repeatedly that it wouldn't matter, that it was just a trivial varicocele. It wasn't significant, it wasn't big. It did get an ultrasound at one point, and the radiologist said it was mild to moderate. I can't tell you when exactly that was in the process. It was definitely after round three. It was after round four, somewhere around round four, round five. That was the point where the varicocele was confirmed, not just me suspecting it based on like maybe being in the gym and being a bit sore and stuff like that. And I was well aware from doing all the kind of research into male fertility that varicoceles did affect male fertility. And I was quite surprised that nobody was wanting to do anything about it. And I was sort of taking them at their word that this isn't going to make a difference. And by round six, I was like, I was starting to like really push it. I was being like, right, well, come on, like six failed rounds. This clearly isn't working. Like the DNA frag on my sperm must be high. That must be what's causing these miscarriages for like seemingly otherwise successful rounds of IVF. This must be a factor that's at least worth exploring, looking into, even if it's not the defining factor, even if based on your experience, it's not going to be the be all and end all. It's one of those marginal gains that we can be looking at. And I couldn't make any traction really with that narrative. And we went into round seven under a different doctor in the same clinic who recommended we do PICSI, like physiological ICSI, which is just another version of ICSI where they put a gel in the dish and they expect this sort of good quality sperm to bind to this gel and they select those sperm for the sperm injection. And they hadn't done the PICSI in this clinic before, so they wanted to do a trial. So I gave them a semen analysis to do a trial and they said they saw no binding, which was, when I heard that, I thought, well, that's really bad actually. Like, and I doubt that was down to lab technique. I think that was just down to the quality of my sperm, was that it wasn't binding at all to this gel. And I thought, like, that's really telling how bad the quality is. And the embryologist wasn't feeling particularly confident about going ahead with it, but the doctor wanted to go ahead with it. So we did round seven with PICSI and we got told we had some binding, which again isn't great. You want to have a decent portion of sperm binding to this gel. And no, the round was effectively another rinse and repeat. Despite this hope of trying this new technology, it was just the embryos didn't really develop. We didn't have anything to implant on day five. Five out of seven rounds, we didn't really have anything to transfer on day five, or we just had something that you knew wasn't going to work. You'd transfer it anyway, because why wouldn't you? But it's not going to work.
How did you feel at that point?
Yeah, so at this point, this is kind of 2.5 years in. This was the end of 2019. Like, I was getting to the point where I was like, we're now kind of at the end of the road. This isn't working. And although we'd had glimmers of hope at round two and round five with a couple of short-lived pregnancies, I was like, this is a disaster. This isn't going to get any better. Feeling pretty low about it at that point. Starting to make my peace with it a little bit. But yeah, like feeling pretty crap about it. And it was such a drawn out process of going from feeling like, oh, this will be fine, ICSI will work, to having these like sort of spikes of hope in the middle of it where you have these pregnancies and then just coming to the end of it and being like, you know what? People who have seven rounds of failed ICSI are significantly less likely to have a successful eighth round or ninth round. That's not to say that they won't, but your odds are really starting to go against you after kind of six or seven rounds. And yeah, at that point, I was like, we need to just stop this, take a break, try something completely different, do something completely different. I think what was frustrating is I'd looked up back in round two, I'd looked up where to go for male fertility advice, male fertility clinics, Mr. Jonathan Ramsey in London, and Andrology Solutions, the kind of scientist-led clinic in London as well. And I thought about going down to London for a long weekend to exploring male fertility, and I never did it. And I should have done. I just carried away with the next round and let's just do it again and let's just try and hope for a better result next time.
Do you think there's a element of that where you thought that because the clinics were giving you a certain path to go down, that was the right one, and to come off piece of that would actually be damaging to your success?
Yes, absolutely. And I definitely felt that throughout the whole process, throughout all the rounds of IVF and ICSI. Even though I was looking into all this lifestyle stuff myself, none of it at any point was conflicting with the advice of the clinic. I wasn't taking anything that they were saying and saying, no, I'm going a different way. I was just supplementing what they were doing. So I was just doing these lifestyle changes and exercise and supplements, none of which was in conflict with what the clinic was telling me to do. And it wasn't really until after seven failed rounds that I thought, do you know what? Well, what's the worst that can happen? Like, this isn't going to work. The way things are going, this isn't going to get better. So I am just going to go and do things that are conflicting with their advice because I'm fed up with this and it's time to make a breaking change to it. At that point, it was COVID hit, of course, 2 months later. And I think it was at that point that I started to feel a bit better about everything we'd been through, taking a break and kind of not having a looming round of IVF coming up that I had to like really hammer my lifestyle. I think that's the point where Julia really started to struggle, though. She'd sort of been bottling up for seven rounds trying to support me, and with it being a male factor problem and a lot of the emotional difficulty was with me, so she was supporting me. And it wasn't, I think it was during COVID that she really started to feel it. I was sent home to work from home, so I was still working and working quite hard. And she was sent home not working from home, so she was just sitting around the flat doing jigsaws and stuff like that. And
a lot of time to think. Often we don't have that time, do we? Because we are just with work and life and just everything. And then fertility stuff is just, you're on, never around, let's go. And then when you have that pause, it gives us that time that we don't often get, which can be a good thing. But I wonder, in this scenario, like, how did you both navigate that? And did you find support both individually or together?
I think we supported each other a lot. I think we were both offered therapy over and over again at the clinic, which is, I think it's required to be offered with IVF rounds. I'm not sure, you guys might be more familiar than I am, but I think IVF clinics are supposed to offer therapy to anyone at all times.
It's got to be available if you need it. So, yeah.
Neither of us took it up. And I think we just supported each other, and we did have friends we would speak to. And I think this is really where Nexus is really filling a big gap. Nobody gets it. And what you guys are doing with Nexus and that male fertility support stuff is really important, because even people who sympathize, they do not get it. But for anyone who is listening, they should definitely look up Nexus, your male fertility support platform, because that was something that wasn't available to me at the time. And I do go along now because I want to be able to support other men, because it's so important. As I say, there were people that I could talk to, but you could see after a time they would sort of not really understand why you were feeling the way you were feeling, or why were you not able to like logically reason your way out of feeling this way. One of my friends I did speak to about it, yeah, he was sympathetic and he was a good ear, but he didn't really get it. And then about a year later, he texted me saying that he'd had a similar result and how hard it had hit him, and he'd gone from not really getting it to suddenly getting it.
Yeah, it's definitely one of those things that you don't understand until you've experienced it. Like, you just can't. It's impossible. I think you can be empathetic to someone. Right? You can understand that they're going through a tough time. But to truly understand what it feels like in your soul, you have to go through it. We've said it 100 times. It's the reason why we started the podcast. It's the reason why we started Nexus, is because unless you've been through it, it's very hard to know how they're feeling. One thing that did stuck out, I thought about it a couple of times while you've been explaining, going through cycle after cycle, but you would have thought at some point someone would have picked this up and said, that's a lot. And if the question there was of DNA fragmentation, at some point that needs to be tested for. Not initially, that's my personal opinion. It's not the first point of contact, but at some point, if the evidence is pointing towards something, it should have been picked up.
Yeah, so I did mention DNA fragmentation a lot in a lot of different visits with, you know, a number of doctors in the same clinics. And I got the same response back, that the evidence at the time wasn't pointing towards it being clinically significant. And that wasn't what I was reading in the scientific literature. When I was reading the literature, I was sort of seeing that it was significant. It did have an impact on fertility and on live birth rates. But I just kept getting this response that it wasn't clinically significant, and I couldn't make my peace with it, but that's just what I kept getting told. And then that applied to repairing the varicose seal, whether they wouldn't consider repairing the varicose seal because it wasn't deemed to be clinically significant. And that was just the opposite of what I was reading in the literature. And I found that really difficult, to be told one thing and to read from a reputable source something completely different. This wasn't some wacky Instagram channel or, you know, somebody's blog.
Did you highlight those reference points to them? Yeah.
And it just wasn't making its way through to clinical guidelines. And I know that Jonathan Ramsay's working pretty hard to try and change that. It's just the way things are right now. To circle back around to the emotional support thing, I've done maybe 20, 25 plus semen analyses. And it wasn't until one of my later semen analyses that I chose to look in the box of goodies in the room, which in a box of magazines, old-fashioned magazines, top shelf stuff. And when I looked in the box, the thing I noticed was it was one of these A4 paper boxes, cardboard boxes, where you stack papers in for like office boxes. And on the inside page of the cardboard, there was all these like messages from other men that people had written there with pen, and all these support messages of men writing messages to other men in a place that the clinical staff and the embryology staff and the nursing staff didn't look, nobody wanted to look at that box, and nobody had noticed that all these men had been writing all these secret messages to each other, supporting each other. And that was probably the place that I got my greatest emotional support from. I don't know when I noticed that. It was late. It was late on in the whole journey for me. But yeah, it was a nice thing. And
did you leave one?
I didn't, and it's a regret of mine. I should have.
Should ask to go back for a help. All time's sake, can I just pop back in the room? But yeah, I mean, you told us that in one of our support groups. And honestly, I've been doing this now for 4.5 years, like sharing my story, talking to other blokes, whatever. And that is one of my favourite ever stories that I've heard. And it was, if there was ever any erring about, is this needed or anything like that, that was one thing that just like, yeah, men need support. That yeah. In the most vulnerable of places and stressful of like, things that you can go through and do, and to, especially if you went 25 odd times. Whew, I thought I'd done a few, but that's quite the number. But yeah, it's to know that men were doing that for each other is just quite incredible.
Yes, it's pretty cool that. It's a unique thing, that, isn't it?
It was nice to discover, and it was it's just a very brief moment of realizing that. Yeah, you're not alone. And, you know, really had felt up until that point that am I the only guy in this clinic that's going through this? I know there'll be other men with bad sperm counts, but am I the only one who's got really bad quality sperm? Am I the only one that's like just doing this rinse repeat cycle over and over again? And yeah, it was just that moment realizing that you're not alone.
It's a strange thing, isn't it? Because you go into a room there, obviously there's no one else in there. My experience was on the way to that room and on the way back, I never bumped into anyone. I never saw anyone. It wasn't like, you don't want it to be the most social events, but it was kind of like there was no one there. So when you're in there, you think, am I the only one that's ever used this room? You do have these thoughts, but then you know that other guys have been in there, and to have found something like that, I could imagine was incredibly powerful in that moment. But if anyone's listening to this and they've had a similar story, it'd be great to hear it. Or if they've had a unique form of support similar to that, where you just wouldn't think it would be, like it would be phenomenal to hear it, because there must be other amazing stories like out there.
Yeah, I think especially being in, I'm sure it'll be relevant to every region, but especially being in Glasgow, a lot of it was written in Glasgow slang and stuff like that.
That's amazing. And that's what it is, isn't it? And that's one thing that me and Sean have found out through this journey. It's like, to get men involved in conversation, you have to speak to them, not just speak about them. So we've got to the point where are you seeing Jonathan Ramsey?
So that's when things changed quite quickly. When decided, yeah, like this lockdown, it was the first summer of lockdown. So it was when things were really quiet. Decided I'm just going to make an appointment with Jonathan Ramsey to see if we can figure something else out. This is a last ditch attempt. Like, either there's a root cause that we can fix or there isn't. Made an appointment. We drove down, middle of COVID. It was when lockdown was lifted, but and infection rates were really low, so it felt safe. But it was quite nice driving around London when the streets were quiet, actually. It was like, never experienced it and don't think I ever will again. But saw Jonathan Ramsey, who investigated me quite thoroughly, sent me on for ultrasounds and blood tests and semen analyses that day, I think, or the ultrasound was a month later, but the blood tests and semen analyses were that day. And COMET test, the DNA fragmentation test, which is something I'd been quite keen to really see the result of. And that included single and double-stranded breaks, which we've talked about a little bit in one of the support groups. And yeah, a month later, got my ultrasound to confirm my varicocele and the state of it. And even that radiologist reported back saying, you know, the varicocele doesn't exceed 3 millimeters, which was the cutoff for what's deemed to be clinically significant in male fertility. Back to Jonathan Ramsey, who interpreted the bloods and the semen analysis and the ultrasound and recommended I go away to get my varicocele embolized by Dr. Stephen Moser. So I booked that in a month later. Dr. Stephen Moser had me on his table, and I've listened to both your stories in the podcast, and it doesn't, your embolization, Sean, sounds a lot more traumatic than mine. Mine's pretty easy, I'm afraid to say. I just lay on this table. I took 2 paracetamol and I don't think I needed them. He just numbed my leg a little bit, put a needle in, and he just talked me through it the whole time. As it happens, my brother is an interventional radiologist, the type of doctor that does these types of procedures. And I spoke to my brother about it, and he doesn't really do a lot of Barracker Seals. And he said, yeah, you want to get done by somebody who's done so many that they're bored of doing them. I think it was probably the case with Dr. Moser. He's done so many. Yeah, it was smooth. It was really easy. I just lay there. He talked me through it. He showed me on the x-ray what he was looking at. About 40 minutes, feel a thing. The only thing I felt at one point was a funny lump kind of in my chest. And I was like, I guess it's a funny lump in my chest. And he said, oh yeah, the tube's gone up. The tube's already in place. I wasn't even aware of it, but it'd gone up my femoral vein, up to my chest, around the corner and back down the other side. And I must have just felt this little tube protruding a little bit against something. I don't know what it was, but it wasn't sore. I just felt a funny little lump. He found the varicose seal, injected it with the right stuff to kill it. He said that's going to hurt a little bit, which it was fine. It felt a little bit like a stitch if you're running, you know. Yeah. And I can't believe I've missed this part of the story. I've got one testicle. So I was about to say my testicle was cold, and I realised that's a funny thing to say. I, a 5-week-old baby, had a hernia, and I lost the blood supply to my right testicle when I was 5 weeks old. So I've grown up with one testicle on the left, and that's all I've ever known. It doesn't bother me. It's never bothered me. But I never really mention it, because it's just not the sort of thing you mention to other blokes and kids at school, and it's just not something you want to go around telling people. It's probably part of my story and why it's maybe more relevant that I have a varicose seal impacting things. Maybe, who knows? Just a couple of days later, I noticed that me and my testicle was feeling quite cool to touch, which was probably the first time maybe ever I had felt cool to touch. I know it sounds bizarre, but if you don't know what you don't know, if you don't know what's normal. And then 2 months later, we had our first natural conception, which did unfortunately lead to another miscarriage. And Mr. Ramsey, who said that after the varicose seal embolization, the DNA fragmentation results had quite dramatically changed. My sperm count had really dramatically changed. I was now up at kind of 7 or 8 million with a motility well over 40%, morphology up as well. Critically, my total motile sperm count was up in the kind of above 40 million range. So I was kind of technically per ejaculate a normal sperm count. And 6 months after that miscarriage, we then had another natural conception, which was our first daughter. 10 months after that, we had another natural conception, which was our second daughter. And again, it just all moved so quickly. We'd gone from thinking this is never going to work, IVF isn't going to work, to you're going to conceive your children naturally. And the whole thing just felt, why did I go through 7 rounds? And here we are with 2 kids, and this is the way it should have been. And this is the way it could have been if we'd investigated the male factor from day one and corrected it.
It's a real incredible ending to what is or was a really traumatic journey for you. You got the ending that everybody wants, including the natural conception, but it could have been a lot less traumatic for you if they'd investigated you appropriately quicker. And rather than just going around this repeat, let's learn from the last one, let's repeat it. You said something right at the beginning in terms of you don't do an experiment twice, do you, and get the same result. Like, you have to change it each time, and it is an incredible journey. It's one of real hope as well. Like, it can happen, and belief in being brave enough to ask that question.
Truly. What comes up for you now, Alistair, when you tell that story in depth and you go through all of that?
Oh, like a mixture of things. I've felt different things over the years. Weirdly guilty to begin with, actually, talking about male fertility. And I don't even know how to describe it. It's like a sort of survivor's guilt or something like that. I don't really know what it was. It was a really strange feeling of, I felt like it wasn't really fair that things worked out for me and not for other people. And I didn't really know how to express that. Still don't. I get pretty annoyed, pretty angry about the situation, like putting Julia through so much of that and putting me through so much of that emotional turmoil, and knowing that there was a solution out there for us and that it wasn't going to be explored. It was never going to be explored without me pushing for it, without people like Mr. Ramsey and Dr. Moser. I also spoke with Melanie Brown, the nutritionist, shortly after I spoke to Mr. Ramsey last time, who gave us, he recommended Melanie Brown to us, and she gave us some great additional lifestyle advice and helped us really push myself to get even better. And that's when things went from a final miscarriage to having successful pregnancies. I felt guilty about the fact that I happened to be from a kind of academic background and kind of knew where to look for information, knew what to do with it. That's kind of why I wanted to start my own website and start my own blog and start talking about that sort of stuff. And yeah, just started this year. So
yeah, that's exciting stuff, man. Tell us about that.
I thought, what did I want? What did I wish existed when I was struggling and when I was going through it all? And I was thinking about it, and I wanted a single credible source of information, a single place to go. I looked around initially, and that's when I found you guys. I found the podcast, I found Nexus in that time. I realized that the space was changing and things were better and things were looking up for men, and the whole space is a much better place than it was 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. And I thought, what kind of man do I want to be? And do I want to be the kind of man that does nothing, or do I want to be like you guys and what you guys are doing? And I knew the answer pretty quickly. So I wanted to get out there and start talking about the stuff I thought was important. The website, which is called Green Man Vitality, they named Vitality, not Fertility, because when you make these lifestyle changes and you make these exercise, sleeping, stress changes, they're good for your overall health. They're good for, like, sperm health is men's health, or at least it's a proxy for it. But as you know, not everybody has sperm. And these lifestyle factors, they're good for you, and they're good for your health and your vitality, and they're good for men in general. And sperm health isn't everything, and your fertility isn't everything. And that's why I didn't want to make it all about specifically fertility and specifically about seeing your sperm, because that's only a part of the journey. And I wanted the website to be for all men, no matter what their diagnosis or whatever their future, and make sure that there was an opportunity for everybody to read credible, evidence-based information about what is good for you, what's good for your sperm, what's good for your overall health. All of these factors are good for heart health and brain health and energy. So I'm quite meticulous in making sure that this is really well evidence-based. All articles should be well cited, and I'm keen to expand it out to be, currently it's just it's blog posts of particular things I found useful to know at the start of my fertility journey, but I'm going to expand it out to recipes and actionable advice.
Making those lifestyle changes is difficult, and quite often it becomes a bit, when you've been doing it for 6 months, it becomes a bit dull, doesn't it? Like, you just feel like you're trudging uphill, walking through the mud all the time. What am I going to eat? How am I going to eat? Can I have this with it? Can I have that with it? So bringing an extra element to that or bit of advice, it's perfect, man. And the more people that talk about it and bring their little bit of expertise to it, you're doing what you're good at, and that's the research and putting it down so people can digest it and trust it. It's amazing, mate.
So thank you for doing that. I mean, how do people find you?
It's manvitality.com, and I've got an Instagram handle as well. I'm fairly new to social media, but manvitality, you should be able to find me.
We'll put it on the show notes as well. We always finish with the same question. Okay, so if you could give one bit of advice to a guy that's facing fertility challenges, what would it be?
There are factors that are in your control to improve your health. That will improve your resilience ahead of whatever your journey ahead is, wherever it goes. So just arm yourself with as much credible information as you can.
Yeah. That's perfect, mate. You don't have to add to that.
Love that.
That is perfect advice. It's been grand having you on, buddy. And yeah, look forward to our next conversation. I'm sure this will happen a few times, because what you're doing is wonderful. Keep going. But until the next time, take care, and we'll speak to you soon. Thanks for listening. If this episode has helped you, do us a quick favor and leave us a review. You don't even have to use your real name. Every single review helps another man find this show when he needs it the most. It's honestly the best way you can help the next guy. If you've got a question or something you'd like us to cover on the mailbag, drop us an email at themalefertilitypodcast@gmail.com. We read every message and we love hearing from our listeners. And if you'd like a bit more expert guidance and support from other men on the same journey as you, you're welcome to join our free private community at nexusfertility.com. It's totally confidential and designed just for you by guys that get it. For our latest updates, follow us on social media at the Male Fertility Podcast. And remember, gents, you're not on your own.